We're going to continue this series on relation slips. We've been looking at different relationships and pitfalls in relationships and how we can look at biblical wisdom to avoid some of those pitfalls. So far, we've been talking about relationships in general, right? Today, we're going to talk about relationships, right? Big R relationships. It's the kind of relationship, if you post on Facebook about being in, then that's the big R relationship. If you're confused about the distinction still, I'm going to explain it thinking of the movie Frozen, right? The Disney movie Frozen. Everybody's seen the Disney movie Frozen? I mean, I only watch it because I have kids, right? No. It's a good movie. It's a good movie, but the movie, it's a love story, but it's not the love story you expect. So two of the main characters are Hans and Anna, and when they meet each other, the very first instant they meet each other, love at first sight, they plan to get married and all these things. That's the big R relationships, right? But as you watch the movie, you realize the movie's not about the love story between Hans and Anna. I'm not going to spoil it for like the three of you who haven't seen it. It's actually about the love between Anna and her estranged sister Elsa, little R relationships. So it's a love story, just not the one you expected. Today, big R relationships and little R relationships, both are important, but today, big R relationships are more important because that's what I'm talking about. So we're going to dig into, as Levi said, the story of the book of Ruth, the story of Ruth and Boaz. This is one of the most ancient stories or love stories in the Bible. It's about 3,000 years old. It actually is a little bit before 1,000 BC. But this story has stood the test of time. And as we dig into it more, I think you'll see, again, like Frozen, it's a love story, just not the love story you expect. We're going to jump into Ruth in a minute, but I do want to jump back to Frozen, because I think there's one more thing we can learn about relationships from Frozen is, you know, if you know anything about their relationship here, one thing that we can learn is if relationships are hard for Disney princesses, for crying out loud, they're going to be hard for us too. And that's been true through all time. You can actually see that in the Bible. Even in the Bible, even many of the great heroes of the faith, they had some interesting issues in their relationships. You can start reading the very first relationship, Adam and Eve. And if you read about Adam and Eve, the very first couple, the first recorded conversation they have is basically blaming each other about who was it that actually let sin into the world in the first place. They start arguing and pointing about that. You can keep going in Genesis. You get to Abraham, who's this great man of faith, and his wife, Sarah, who's a woman of faith as well, except when Abraham, on two occasions, he goes to visit a king, and he tells the king, oh, this Sarah here, she's my sister. And then the king tries to marry Sarah. And that's really, really awkward. Today, you would end up in a lot of marital counseling for something like that. So Abraham and Sarah had interesting relational issues. You look at Jacob. Todd spoke on that last week, and that was awesome. And Jacob, he worked 7 years because he loves Rachel so much to win her hand. And then on the marriage night, what does he do? He marries the wrong person. And you're like, well, that was awkward. And then the relationship gets even more complicated from there. There's Samson. Samson and Delilah, we know that story and how that ends. But there's actually, if you didn't know, Samson tried to get married before that. He attempts to get married, except the wedding, it ends in a literal bloodbath with lots of people dying. It's kind of like the original Red Wedding. And Samson, the bride is given away because the guy's like, I didn't even think you wanted her anymore after everybody, all this. So you know you have relationship issues. If your relationship with Delilah is one of your better relationships, that's not a good sign. You can go on to David. You look at David, and we're told in Scripture that David is a man after God's own heart, except when he's a man after Uriah's wife, and he commits adultery with Bathsheba. So we see a lot of heroes of the faith, they had some of their issues in relationships. I think it's a good point to remember. If even Disney princesses have issues in relationships, if even some of these great examples in Scripture, if they have difficulties in relationships, it's probably true that we're going to have hard relationships sometimes too. And I think the truth is there probably are people here who might be in hard relationships right now. There's people here who maybe they're carrying around scars from past relationships that were really hard. And there's some of you here that are young people. Maybe you've never even been in a relationship, but a lot of you are going to have relationships that end up being difficult at some point in your life. And I think the one thing that we can take courage from, though, is, you know, it's okay. There's lots of people in the Bible, great people of faith, who had their struggles in relationships. It's okay. God can still use you. God still loves you just as much. There's grace. You can be a strong follower of Jesus, even if you've had your difficulties in relationships. But what we're here for today is we want to look at positive examples in scriptures because we want to avoid the hard relationships and actually have healthy relationships. And there's plenty of examples of that in scripture too. So with that, we are going to look at the story of Ruth and Boaz. And this is one of my favorite couples in the Bible. We're going to look at the story. And I think, like I said, we'll find out it's a love story, but just not the one we expected at the beginning. The book of Ruth, you're welcome to turn there if you want. I'm going to show some of the scripture up there, but we're actually going to cover three chapters, so I'm going to have to do some summarizing to bring us up to speed. But actually, the book of Ruth starts with the words, in the days when the judges ruled. First of all, this is a long time ago, well before King David became king over Israel. But that phrase, in the days when the judges ruled, that's kind of cold in the Bible. It's like a code for in the days when things were really, really messed up. And if you read the book of Judges, you kind of know what I'm talking about. Lots of things were really messed up back then. But this is when this story is set, in the days when the judges ruled. And when you read the book of Ruth, pretty quickly, you're introduced to the person who seems like they're going to be the main character. It right away mentions this guy, Elimelech, and says that he lived in Bethlehem, but there was a famine, so he decided he had to move his family to somewhere else that had food. So he goes down to Moab, a different country, with different gods, so that they can make a living. And he brings his wife, Naomi, and his two sons. But when you read the book, like there's this major plot twist, only five verses into the entire book, Elimelech and his two sons drop dead. And the only ones we're left with are Naomi and then the two Moab women that his sons married. So his sons came down and they married Ruth and they married Orpah. Not Oprah, Orpah. So basically, the male figures, they die out in just a few verses, and we're left with Naomi and Ruth that the book is really going to zoom in on. And this is kind of unique, especially in like literature 3,000 years old. Most all the cultures then were very male-dominated, so to have a book that focuses on women is a pretty unique thing, and we have it right here in Scripture. But we jump into the story, and as you can imagine, Naomi is just absolutely distraught. She's lost her husband, Elimelech, and she's lost her two sons. Not only is she mourning, but she has no way to provide for herself. In fact, at the end of the chapter, she tells people not to call her Naomi, but to call her Mara, because Mara means bitter, and that's how she feels. So she decides, I've got nothing left to live for in Moab. So she says, I'm just going to go back home to Bethlehem. But there's these two daughter-in-laws who are from Moab, and she's like, what are they going to do in Bethlehem? You know, that's not going to be good for them. So we enter into the story in verse 8 when she's going to talk to them and she wants to send them back to their home. So this is what it says. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you, to your mother's home, and may the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. She's saying, go back to your parents' home in Moab because there's a chance you're going to find another husband. And this was important for a widow in that time because, again, in those cultures, only males were the ones who provided. So if you weren't attached to a male, you didn't really have a way to make a living. And Naomi says, you're not going to be able to get remarried realistically if you come to Bethlehem, this whole new land. You should go back home. There's another important thing she says here that I want us to key in on. She uses this word twice. She says, may the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. That word kindness, we're going to see it again, and it's going to be very important. So for now, just remember that word kindness. But as the story continues, you see Ruth, she lives out this example of kindness because when Naomi says, go back to your home, Ruth says, no, I'm not going to go home. I'm going to go with you. She says, where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your gods will be my gods. Or your God will be my God. She's becoming a monotheist now, right? Presumably. So anyway, Ruth says, no, I'm going to go with you, Naomi. In your pain, in your mourning, in your suffering, I'm going to go with you. And I'm going to give my entire life to being loyal to you. It's an example of this kindness. So Naomi and Ruth, they return to Bethlehem. So that's great, except the issue is they're destitute. They don't have any way to make a living. They don't even have food. Because again, they have no husbands, they have no male heirs, they have no one in that society that would be able to take care of them, and they don't have systems in place for them to just be supported. So Naomi is understandably very despondent at this point, but Ruth, even though Ruth has recently been widowed herself, Ruth has this like unstoppable, indomitable spirit. She says, no, I'm going to go out and I'm going to do something. I'm going to go out into a field and glean. She's going to go glean. If you don't know like that term gleaning, this was a part of Moses' law in the Old Testament. He said that when a farmer went through his field, he wasn't allowed to go back a second time and pick up anything he may have missed the first time. Anything that the farmer missed at harvest time, people were just allowed to come in the field and they were allowed to pick up that food and have it for themselves. It was one of God's provisions for the poor people. We see a lot of that in Scripture, God's heart for the poor. And it was a way that people who had nothing, they could go glean in a field and they could hopefully make enough food to eat during harvest time. And it was dangerous work for a woman especially. It was hard work, but Ruth says, no, I got this. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to go glean so we have food to eat. And in the beginning of chapter 2, it says, it just so happens, doesn't really just so happen, but just so happens that she ends up in the field of a man named Boaz. So this is where we're going to pick it up here in this conversation between Ruth and Boaz as she goes to his field. And I'm going to be honest here, sometimes it's easy to read this conversation here kind of like some sort of Christian romance novel or something like that, right? You could kind of be like, they're flirting here, what's going on? And I'll be honest, like, I became a Christian in college, and I read the book of Ruth for the first time, and I was convinced that this is what was happening here in this passage. It's like, they're totally flirting with each other. This isn't the right reading. This isn't, I'm not saying this is accurate, but this is kind of how, in my mind, I read this passage here in this interaction, right? This is how I thought of it as. Boaz comes to the field, and he sees Ruth, so he asks the overseer, who does that young woman belong to, right? Like, whoa. There's a fine-looking lady. Who is she? The overseer is like, she's a Moabite, came back with Naomi. She's been working hard right till now. And then in verse 8, Boaz says to Ruth, my daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with the woman who worked for me, and whenever you are thirsty later, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled. Right? He's like, hey, girl, glean in my fields. I'm going to keep my eye on you. Wink, wink. This is how I pictured it in my mind. And then Ruth, down at the bottom, it says, at this she bowed down with her face to the ground, and she asked him, why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner? And Boaz replies, next slide. Boaz replies, well, I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. And he says, may the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord. And Ruth says, may I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord. And then finally they get to mealtime that day, and Boaz says, come over here, have some bread and dip it in the wine vinegar. Right? It's easy to read it that way, and I'm just being honest. This is kind of how I imagined it when I first read this passage in college. Full disclosure, I didn't just imagine this way. I distinctly remember reading this out loud with voices and everything to the guys I lived with in a Nirvana scene saying, isn't this what's happening here? I was like, it looks like they're totally flirting going on. But I have to tell you something. After starting the book of Ruth more, this is not right. This is actually not what is happening here at all. In fact, if you study it, you realize it's almost, in some ways, kind of the opposite. The person writing the book of Ruth is trying to get us a lot of clues to show us that Ruth, she is not attractive. She's not attractive for marriage. I mean, I don't mean like physical looks. We don't know what Ruth looked like, and we don't know what Boaz looked like. But the person writing the book is trying to show that Ruth is not marriage material. Naomi knows this. That's why she says, go back to your home, because you're not going to find a husband if you come to Bethlehem. You're a foreigner, right? This isn't going to happen. There's three reasons, really, why Ruth is kind of shown to be not someone that Boaz would be looking to marry at all. First of all, she's destitute, right? She has nothing. She's gleaning, basically begging, in his field. Even the word that she uses for herself, that I'm a servant, puts her well low, well below Boaz's station, as someone he would never consider marriage with. I know today we kind of love stories, right, where people from high places fall in love with people from low places. And that's probably like the only reason people follow the British royal family anymore is because, like, you know, we want to see something like that happen. We love stories like that. But back then, class distinction was more important. You know, Boaz, a man of means, he wouldn't be looking for someone who's begging and gleaning in his field as a potential spouse. Second strike against Ruth, and this is, I think, much bigger. We didn't read these parts of chapter 1 and also in chapter 4, but it strongly implies that Ruth is unable to have children. Right? She was married for up to 10 years to Mahlon, was the name of her husband, before he died, and they had no children. In that culture, you didn't wait to have children. That wasn't a thing. If you didn't have children by that point, it was because you couldn't have children. And I mean, we know today that that's a really hard thing. But back then, having children was paramount. And even harder is back then, they didn't have the medical understanding that we do today, that there could be a variety of reasons for not being able to have children. Back then, if a couple couldn't have children, they all saw it as because the wife was barren. That's the way they understood it. And that's not necessarily right, but that's the level of medical understanding they had. So Ruth would have been looked at as someone who was infertile, that she could not have children. And that was really important in that society. So again, not someone Boaz would be looking at as a spouse. The third strike against Ruth, and I think this is the biggest, is, right, she's a Moabite. She's from Moab. This is a different country with different gods, right? They're not worshiping God Yahweh that we know. And if you know their history of their interaction with Israel, it's kind of spotty. You can read the story of how Moab started as a nation. If you go back to Genesis, you read the story of Lot and his daughters. But we're in a church right now, so I'm not going to really say anything more about that story because it's kind of sketchy. You could keep going, and there's another instance where women from Moab go out and they try to seduce the Israelite men. They try to get them to turn away from God and commit idolatry through sexual sin. So they have that in their history. Recently, as far as their times, it says in the days of Judges, there was a king, a big fat Moabite king named Eglon, who oppressed the Israelites for 18 years. And this is the time that Ruth and Boaz are living in. So this would not be someone that Boaz would see and be like, yeah, she's someone I should be looking for in a spouse, right? There's a lot of things going against Ruth that would make her unattractive. Really, what the person writing the story is trying to do, it's showing Ruth as one of the most vulnerable in society. If you read the Old Testament, you know that again and again, God talks about his heart for the orphan and the widow and the stranger and how people should care for them, or the orphan, widow, and foreigner. Really, Ruth is kind of like all these in one. You know, she's a widow for sure because her husband died. She's a foreigner because she's moved from a different land. And in practice, she's practically like an orphan because she's left her parents' home. She's left her care. She has no one to look out for her. So she's kind of this orphan, widow, and foreigner that people are supposed to care for. What the passage is doing is showing here that Boaz, in this interaction, he's such an upright man. He goes above and beyond that he cares for this type of people. When he doesn't have to. There's plenty of people who didn't follow the laws to let people glean in their field or didn't help people like this. But Boaz is showing as someone who goes out of his way to care for people like this. He's not flirting with her, but he's caring for her. So back to our passage. It's easy to think of Boaz as like this George Clooney of 1000 BC, right? He's like this handsome older gentleman, and Ruth is this like beautiful exotic woman from another place, and they're falling in love. But that's not what happens here. That's not what's happening. And to be honest, like the way that I read that, that's because I had that misunderstanding about the book of Ruth when I first read it. I had a misunderstanding about the relationship and what was happening here. To be honest, too, that's not the only time I've had a misunderstanding about relationships. It's not just when I look at the Bible. I've had plenty of misunderstandings of how relationships work in real life. And I even had like a big list of them, but I had to cut some of that out to fit my sermon in. But I think the biggest thing that I could think of, you know, when I first started thinking about relationships, right, when I was, you know, maybe at high school age, getting into college age, a lot of you guys are that age. When I started thinking about relationships at first, I really had a poor understanding of what relationships were about. I had a misunderstanding of what they were about. I thought relationships were about the physical aspect. I objectified women. I thought that's what it was all about. Now, if you ask me, I wouldn't have verbalized it that way because I think I knew in my head that it wasn't supposed to be that way. But in my heart, that's kind of how I live things out. That's kind of how I did things. I think it's easy, even for us today, it's easy to start believing that lie about relationships, that relationships are just about the physical aspect. I think it's really easy for young people to start believing that lie, even if they know in their head it's not true, simply because we live in a world where we're bombarded by that message again and again and again, aren't we? You know, you watch a movie, a TV show, you go on the internet, you see any advertisements, commercials, you can just walk through Walmart and or wherever, you know, any grocery store that has magazines at the checkout line, and it gets the message again and again that that's what relationships are really about. It's about sex, right? And young people are getting bombarded by that message. They're being told that they're not attractive enough, that you're not pretty enough, that you're not manly enough, that you're not good-looking enough, that you're not having enough sex. I think even when we know in our head that that's not true, it's really hard because we're immersed in a world that's telling us that again and again and again. And sometimes our heart starts to believe that, at least on some level. And I know for me, when I was young, it came out in an addiction to pornography. And that only led to emptiness and pain for me. But that's the truth. The truth is when we believe lies about relationships, it only leads to pain. It only leads to pain. Fortunately for me, I became a Christian when I got to college. And after being a Christian for a while, God really worked through those lies and totally changed my life. It was the healthiest thing that ever happened. But when we buy into those lies, it leads to pain. And I think the big question young people have to ask themselves today is, can I trust God with my sexuality? Because the world's trying to tell you, no, you can't. But the people who follow the wisdom of the world usually end up in pretty painful relationships. Let's back to our story about Ruth and Boaz. Okay, so we've established that there's not like all this flirting that's really going on here. That's not what's really happening. It's just showing that Boaz is this upstanding character who really cares for Ruth and Naomi and wants to help them, right? This poor, destitute, barren, foreign woman who comes in his field. And he tries to do what's right. And you can see this more as we get to the end of chapter 2. So what happens is on that first day, Ruth works the whole day trying to glean, but then at the end of the day, Boaz gives her like this giant sack of grain. Like, you know, so much that she could probably hardly carry it home. This is like way more than anybody could ever glean in a single day. The amount that she gets from Boaz is like enough to feed Naomi and her for like a week or two, just on that one day alone. So she's coming home, right, like carrying this huge sack of grain that you would never be able to glean on your own. And she walks in the door, and Naomi here, it says, her mother-in-law saw this and asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Right? She's like, "What the heck is going on here?" Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. She said, "The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz." Now, Naomi's going to respond to this. And what Naomi says here is one of the keys to understanding what's happening. Because first she says, "The Lord bless him." And then Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and to the dead." We see that word again. Remember I told you it'd be important? Kindness? So again, remember it. We're going to come back to it again. But Naomi says, "He," and that's a lot of commentators think it's ambiguous. It's supposed to be Boaz and God has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. And then she adds this, and this is critical. She says, "That man is our close relative. He is our guardian redeemer. He is our guardian redeemer. So what is guardian redeemer? I mean, wasn't he in like the last Avengers movie helping like save the universe or something like that? You know, what is guardian redeemer? Well, this guardian redeemer, actually it's an Old Testament term again. Sometimes it's called kinsman redeemer. But it's something that is prevalent throughout the Old Testament. To get an idea of what guardian redeemer is, let's pop this definition up here from the all-knowing Bible Gateway. It says, guardian redeemer was a close, influential relative to whom members of the extended family could turn for help, usually when the family line of possessions were in danger of being lost. So they were supposed to help in several ways, buying back family land, buying back enslaved relatives, providing an heir for a dead brother, avenging the killing of a relative, and caring for relatives in difficult circumstances. So there's a few of these in play at the book of Ruth, but the one that makes Naomi look at Ruth and Boaz and go, it's the one about providing an heir for a dead brother. Because this is what was supposed to happen. And this is going to sound weird because it's 3,000 years ago. But again, in that culture, if a woman's husband died and she had no children, especially no sons, to provide for her, she had no way to make a living. She was incredibly vulnerable. So they didn't have life insurance back then, right? God hadn't invented insurance companies or anything like that. So what they did to make sure that people were provided for, that these widows were provided for, what they did is said that if a woman's husband died, then the brother was supposed to marry her and father a child so that she would be provided for. And I know it seems weird because it's, you know, 3,000 years ago, but that's the way that they did things. So Naomi looks at this and thinks, you know, what's going on here? But here's the issue. You know, Ruth's husband, his name was Mahlon. When he died, his only brother also died. So that's not going to work. There's no brother of Ruth's husband. Boaz actually fits more closely as the guardian redeemer of Naomi. But if you read through more chapter 1, you're actually told, Naomi just tells Ruth and Orpah, I'm too old to have kids anymore. That's not going to happen. So that's not going to work at all either. So really, Boaz, he's under like no technical obligation to do anything. But if he's a man who cares not just about the letter of the law, but he cares about the spirit of the law, right? If he cares about this provision that he's supposed to be caring for relatives in difficult circumstances, Naomi thinks, maybe there's something here that might happen. So she's got to figure this out. Could Boaz be this guardian redeemer they're looking for? So she decides that she's going to hatch a plan. She's going to roll a dice, risk everything, and find out if Boaz will fit as the guardian redeemer and would marry Ruth. So you go through the rest of chapter 2, and it just says in the very last verse that Ruth worked in Boaz's fields for the remainder of the harvest season. So that would be several weeks. So they're not just one-time acquaintances at this point. But she works there for the rest of the season. But now it's the last day of the harvest season, which means that this is the last day Ruth can glean. This is the last day she can go and get food for her and Naomi. After this, what are they going to do? So again, Naomi talks to Ruth, and she comes up with this risky plan. And this is what she tells Ruth to do. She says to Ruth, now, Boaz, with whose woman you have worked, is a relative of ours. Tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash, put on perfume, and get dressed in your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. And when he lies down, note the place where he is lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. So some of you are listening to this plan, and this is basically what Ruth does. She follows Naomi's words almost to the letter. She just goes, she sneaks at night in her best clothes down to the threshing floor. She watches Boaz, sees where he lies down, where he falls asleep, you know, in the night, in the dark. She goes, uncovers his feet, and lies down next to him, you know, presumably waiting for the cold air to wake him up. And some of you hear that plan, and you're like, wow, you know, that's kind of sketchy, isn't it? Right? That's kind of a sketchy plan. But the truth is, it's actually pretty sketchy. It is a sketchy plan. In fact, it's sketchy enough that a lot of people read this book of Ruth and they say, well, Ruth and Boaz, they slept together. The Bible's just tiptoeing around it. That's what it's trying to tell us here. There's a lot of people who come to that conclusion. But I'll tell you what, I think this is, again, a total misunderstanding of what's happening in the relationship here, and it's a belief in that lie that relationships are, of course, all about physical intimacy. They're all about having sex. It's easy to believe that lie and think, oh, that's just what happened here. It might help to understand, like, when Ruth puts on these clothes, it's not like she's dressing all these, you know, seductively and going out there to seduce Boaz. Commentators agree, like, when she changes the clothes, this probably is simply saying that before she's been wearing clothes that mark her as a widow in mourning, because her husband recently died, and now Naomi says, okay, don't wear those clothes anymore. Change out of those clothes to signify that you're no longer in the period of mourning, so you're open to remarriage at this point. So Ruth does that. She puts on these clothes. But she goes down there, right? She's a young, vulnerable woman. She's going there in the middle of the night, alone, to a man. She's going to the threshing floor, which there's some background there. Threshing floors, they had a certain reputation sometimes for certain iniquities that could happen there with other ladies who would visit from time to time. It was known as a place like that. So she's going to this place, and it is kind of sketchy. And the person who's writing Ruth wants us to understand this. This is a dangerous plan. It's a risky plan. We're concerned. Is Ruth going to be compromised? All of this plan depends on Boaz being an upright person, like the passage has been describing him as. But what if he's just faking being a righteous person, right? I mean, we can look at the news today. There's lots of people who fake being righteous men. What if Boaz is faking? He could use and abuse Ruth, and there'd be no repercussions at all. Or what if Boaz is a legalistic righteous man, and as soon as he sees Ruth, he just shames her and just kicks her out, right? That could happen as well, too. It's a pretty dangerous plan. But what happens here? So let's keep going. So Ruth has uncovered his feet, and then eventually he wakes up, and I assume at this point he's probably pretty groggy. It's dark, he's just been sleeping, and he's like, who are you? And then Ruth, and say one thing about Ruth, say she's incredibly bold. She says, I am your servant Ruth. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family. So you know what she's saying? Do you know what this means? Spread the corner of your garment over me? This means marry me. That's the language they used. Spread the corner of your garment over someone meant to marry them. So she wakes Boaz up and she says, marry me. You're the kinsman redeemer, guardian redeemer for our family. Right? I mean, it's weird today to have a woman propose to a man, but 3,000 years ago in a male-dominated culture, we have the woman asking the man to marry him, or to marry her. We have the younger person asking the older person to get married. We have the poor person asking the richer person. We have the foreigner asking the Israelite to marry her. And, you know, the narrator, like, this is like, what's going to happen? You know, what is Boaz going to do? Is he just going to laugh at her? Be like, are you serious? Who do you think you are? Is he going to shame her and be like, oh my gosh, get out of here. What are you doing? Is he going to just be like, I'm just going to, you know, use you physically? Because again, that could happen as well. It's a risky plan. And again, remember, Ruth is not like this, you know, there's been sparks flying between her and Boaz and this incredible chemistry. She's shown to be someone, it's not like she's just great marriage material. The only thing that would give Ruth hope for Boaz to say yes is his duty as guardian redeemer. Or perhaps there is something else. Maybe there is another reason that this might work. And I think we see this as we keep going. So let's look at the next part. This is how Boaz answers. He says, the Lord bless you, my daughter. And then he says, this kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. Right? There's that word again, this kindness. Right? It's been three times in three chapters. This word kindness, it's actually one of the keys to help understanding the book of Ruth, And it's one of the keys to helping understand this message. It's one of those words that's hard to translate from Hebrew to English. So one commentary had this to say about the word that's translated as kindness. That word is actually in Hebrew, it's called hesed. And it said, hesed is one of those words whose meaning cannot be captured in one English word. This is a strong relational term that wraps up in itself an entire cluster of concepts. All the positive attributes of God, love, mercy, grace, kindness, goodness, benevolence, loyalty, covenant faithfulness. In short, that quality that moves a person to act for the benefit of another without respect to the advantage it might bring to the one who expresses it. This is what the book of Ruth is really focusing in on, right? It's why in the very first chapter, Naomi tells Ruth, she says, you know, you have showed kindness to me and to your husbands, right? It labels Ruth as this person who possesses this quality of hesed right from the very beginning. And then we're showing that. It's demonstrated when Ruth, despite all odds, she sticks with Naomi. She's totally loyal to Naomi and Naomi's hurt and suffering. And she goes to Bethlehem. She goes out in the fields and risks hard work and danger to provide for Naomi. She possesses this character of hesed, this loving kindness and faithfulness, this loyalty, and this putting of others before herself. And then when you meet Boaz right away, he's shown to have this type of characteristic too. He has this hesed as well, this faithful, loving kindness, right? He goes to his field and he's kind not just to his workers, but he's incredibly kind to Ruth, this poor, destitute woman from Moab who comes to glean in his field. He doesn't just let her do that, but he goes above and beyond to make sure she's provided for and Naomi's provided for. And then Naomi expresses that after Ruth comes back carrying that evangel potluck-sized bag of grain where she's like, this is huge, we're going to eat for a week. Right? Naomi says, you know, he has not stopped showing his kindness. Right? Boaz is told that he has this type of character too, this hesed. And then when Ruth comes to him at night and wakes him up, this is the first thing he says. He says, you know, this kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. This is the whole key, right? He recognizes that Ruth has that kindness too. It's not about like this incredible physical attraction between the two. It's not about all this flirting that's going on or this amazing chemistry between Ruth and Boaz. The thing that attracts them is that they both possess this incredibly upright moral character. They both possess this quality of hesed, loving, faithful kindness, and putting others before themselves. And not only do they possess it, but they're able to recognize it in each other. And that's what makes this relationship work, right? It's a love story. It's just not the love story we are expecting. And if you read the rest of Ruth, there is a happily ever after ending, after another plot twist that gets in there. You can finish it off on your own. I don't have enough time to cover the rest of it. But we do see that because of Boaz and Ruth, because of this incredible hesed, this faithful, loving kindness that puts others before themselves that they have, because of that, through all the pain and suffering and hardships in the book of Ruth, we see that everything works out for them because they both possess this hesed and they're able to see it in each other. So, I want to ask you, what about you? What about you? Do you possess this hesed? Do you possess this quality, this faithful, loving, graceful, merciful, benevolent kindness, this willingness to put others before yourself? Because I think that's the very nature of Christ. I think we see the gospel of Jesus and his loving self-sacrifice for us. We see that hinted at in the book of Ruth, right? Do we possess this quality of hesed? Because if I could give you guys one piece of relational advice, I'd say this. It's pursue that quality of hesed. Pursue it in yourself and pursue it in others and anyone who would be in a relationship with. Because if you do those things, you're going to have healthy relationships. And I want to say, if you're a young person today, you know, your high school age, college age, post-college age, and you're thinking about, you know, what should I look for in relationships or what should I do? I'd say that's the number one thing. You know, you want to look for someone who loves Jesus as much as you love him. You want to look for someone who has hesed, right? The number one thing you could do is develop those characteristics of hesed in yourself and pursue someone who also has those characteristics. And I think there's different ways you can do that, right? That's what the church is supposed to be about, you know? Volunteer to serve in the church sacrificially. Do something that's not about yourself, but giving back. And do that with the whole intention of trying to become more loyal, faithful, kind. Think about getting involved in something on campus. There's InterVarsity, there's Crew, there's His House. But a lot of those students are sacrificing a lot to serve other students on campus, to reach out to other students on campus who don't even know Jesus. That's a great way to grow in this characteristic of hesed. Think about giving one of your summers up. Everybody knows you got to make money and you got to get experience. And those are great things, but I think this quality of hesed is worth far more than any of those things. Give a summer up and pursue something that's just going to help you grow in this quality of hesed. And if while you're doing that, or doing any of those things, you notice someone else who has those same characteristics as you do, maybe then it's a good time to start praying about, should I be in a relationship, right? I know that's how I met my wife when I was a college student at Michigan Tech. And she was doing stuff in Crew, and I was doing stuff in InterVarsity, and we were serving on the campus. And we're like, wow, look at that. You know, we see that. But I want to challenge you guys, you know, pursue that quality of hesed. Because I think if you do, and if you do that in yourself, and you learn to recognize that quality of hesed in others, just like Ruth and Boaz did, I think you have a really good chance of having strong, healthy relationships, including big R relationships. So, thanks.